And then I can mention these people and how that played out.
Okay. And I could just tell that there is sound and I can hear both of us.
Okay.
And I can say that today is July 24th, 2014. And this is Karen Brewster and Dave Klein continuing with Dave telling us about his life. And today we're going to do more on the research and people he's worked with. So Dave, you were saying before I turned on the recorder about sort of mentors and colleagues and how you wanted to talk about that a little bit.
Right. And it's sometimes that if you're among your colleagues at the university, you know, you have us longer term people and the full professors and versus the associate professors and the newer people, the associate professors. And when everybody starts in up there, especially when you're coming directly from your first time as a faculty member in a university and got a lot to learn about, when you apply, you think you're pretty good in this field that you did your own research in, and you got a lot of good experience, but you don't have the experience of working with students, and you're not alone, fortunately, because any degree that's being done there by a student, whether it's a master's or a PhD, there's an advisory committee, and the chairman of that committee is the major advisor for the student. And so the concept of advanced degrees at the master's level is, in a sense, primarily training, but you want them to contribute to science if possible, but it's not essential. I mean, if they're learning all of the skills necessary to do research, that in itself, if they do it well, it might have a little bit of research, but it's not necessarily justifying a full publication from it. But if you get one, so much the better. Mm-hmm. And a PhD, it's a bit different. The student has more freedom in choosing their research, and then the PhD thesis is supposedly primarily the work of the student with advice and approval as they proceed by the major professor and periodic meetings with the whole committee, so that sure, they're on track to meet university requirements for the degree programs, but also they're making progress, and they should need help to be sure they make progress.
And the PhD also needs to be more of a contribution to science?
That's the intent, yeah, and it's usually is the case. So sometimes, depending upon how much how the research might be fractured in relationship to how the research was done. So some things naturally fall into two or three papers or more, whereas others might be one big paper, which would be like a monograph, because it's hard to break them up into individual papers. So you could have chapters, but it would be all. And from the standpoint of their future career, of course, the number of papers is unfortunately emphasized more mm-hmm. than the quality of the papers. But the major professor wants to assure that that the quality is high, because that reflects on him or her or the major professor and the university program where they are and the university where they come from. So you get a reputation, the university gets a reputation, and it's dependent upon the faculty and the students and their productivity and the quality. And that's over years, that's all important. Mm-hmm. And what I can say in terms of the University of Alaska Fairbanks is that we went from when I first was there as a student, but even as starting as a professor, I was one of the few people that was considered working primarily at the graduate level with students, and other faculty had so much responsibility and their salary was tied to teaching courses, they didn't have time to do much advising. I could advise, be on a committee, but not as a major professor. Well, gradually the research institutes gained reputation nationally and internationally and here at UAF, and our own graduate program, which was initiated very early on in the 1950s. Gradually we got more students, and they helped to build a good record of theses. And early on, some of the master's students, before we were approved to have a PhD program, the master's theses were literally PhD theses, because the students were so turned on and their advisors were turned on, and they went ahead and did outstanding degrees, and then they frequently, those went on for do a PhD somewhere else, and we were being criticized by that we were being overtrained at the master's level. It wasn't fair to the students. Mm-hmm. Well, our view was it was definitely fair to the student, because the students, when they applied, they had this beautiful work at the master's level, with maybe a publication or two out of it, and that meant they could get into a better university, and they are going to do a better job at the PhD. And it's not just having a degree because it helps you to get a job. Getting a degree, then you have a CV that supports it, and with a publication record and advisors and people, references that are willing to say, yeah, this is an outstanding person. They proved themselves already in the master's, and definitely good to take them on for PhDs. Mm-hmm. But, for example, some of the colleagues that I was working with here as a new faculty member, one was like Dale Guthrie, who was a paleontologist, and as a he was a good one, but he had got a degree at the University of Chicago and worked with mainly with the fossil teeth of small mammals like voles and mice and maybe as big as ground squirrels, but not with bigger animals then. And learning how to examine and use the teeth and differentiate down to the species level, even though all you found was a tooth, and when you're sifting through some old soils that go back for a long ways.
I would think, yeah, as a paleontologist like that, you would need to have some experience with biology.
Oh, they did.
A modern animal to make those comparisons and understand what they were looking
at. They had good training in biology, but not much in general ecology. They had good in other areas, whereas I was well trained in ecology because I was interested in not just wildlife and wildlife management, but also the plant relationship and where do these big herbivores like moose and elk and deer, how do they feed and what do they get out of it?
And some of that come from the education you got in Connecticut and who you studied under, and they were looking at those bigger issues and it got you
thinking.
Some
of it came from my interest in plants as well as mammals primarily.
Right.
I was interested in birds, but it was primarily mammals. And it was primarily deer and larger.
Right.
And but then when I arrived here, I'd done my PhD in Southeast Alaska on deer ecology, but it was definitely a plant-animal interaction.
You always were conscious of the plant-animal interaction.
Yeah.
That was always your interest.
How does the animal influence the plant, and how does the plant influence the animal, and what does the plant... Then I got into this field of what did the plant have, if it's nutritious and good for the animal, why isn't it eaten to the point where it couldn't survive? Well, sometimes it is. If the density of the population is so high, they're overgrazing or browsing what's a natural vegetation, selectively removing all the good high quality ones and nothing left but sort of like junk food that doesn't digest easily, mm-hmm. and the body condition of the animals go down. So, and the same true, you have to think about the evolution and the ecology and nutrition of the animals, and that's where Bob White, Dr. Robert White, who came as a postdoc from Australia after I'd been here a couple of years and was a wildlife unit leader, and I sort of adopted him because I liked him, and he was an animal physiologist, and he was interested in how the function of the rumen of sheep and cows worked in relationship to the horses, which have a different kind of a system. And so, and they had done research for, and some of his PhD's work in Australia was that way. And he continued some of that up here before he finally finished his degree. And so I could give him lots of opportunities to work with caribou and reindeer out in the Aleutians, which I was working on, and studying plant and animal relationships. But I'd invite him along, and then he would opportunities for him to collect data on animals that I would shoot some to get a body condition and look for parasites and diseases. And he could work with the fresh killed animals and do some quick studies to see what kind of organisms were in their stomachs, but also what kind of fermentation processes were going on, and what, and bring samples back and see which, whether protozoa or bacteria were more important in the kind of food that they were digesting, and especially when they were taking a diversity of species which don't normally occur on rangelands. Like rangelands are dominated, especially in Australia, by grasses, and Alaska, for in the wild habitat for caribou, there's grasses, but there's also sedges and lichens, and you know, what's the difference there? And so, both he and I had interests that both overlapped, but they overlapped with northern animals, northern mammals, northern herbivores. And so we made, frequently when one of us would make contacts with someone overseas, they would stimulate some kind of collaboration, and the other person would be involved too. And so we both did a lot of traveling and had research that would enable us to work in, say, especially Scandinavia, and other places like Greenland and Iceland and Canada. And so when we had students, they frequently were working on a topic that was related to either his interests or mine, but we'd each serve on the other's graduate committee, because we brought this, for him, I brought in this ecology, and for me, he brought in physiological ecology. And so we were broadening our own knowledge, and he was just a physiologist, and he was becoming well established as a physiological ecologist, and was actually starting to work with wildlife too. And a lot of that was collaborative research, and our students sometimes were, we were sort of like co-advisors for them. Sometimes we were on each other's graduate committees. And so,
yeah, it sounds like you and Bob has sort of a symbiotic relationship with the, you would maybe kill a caribou to understand it for what you were looking at, like body condition and all that, and then, oh, well, there he could get his samples all at the same time. And it was a great collaboration.
And we're always kidding one another, because when we're out in the Aleutians, there were sheep out there. And I always kidded him that he was happier when he could jump into a corral with a bunch of sheep.
As an Australian?
Yeah, right. And but there was a similar situation with Dale Guthrie, because he became focused on ecology, and he's trying to explain what kind of an environment these animals were living in, like mammoths and musk oxen and horses in Alaska, when there was full glaciation. And we knew that there weren't many trees around then, and what were they eating? And well, there were other people doing studies on vegetation on south-facing slopes, which had sort of a relic of what with artemisia and a lot of grasses and some flowering plants, and they also had pollinating insects that were typical of those places, which were the same ones that would be out there. And some he by looking at ground squirrel nests, and often sometimes with ground squirrels in them because they got frozen out, there would be the seeds that the male ground squirrel brought in there. And because when they come out of hibernation, there's nothing to eat. They do it because they're males and they have to establish a territory. So then they dig into the tunnels of females and breed them. When they start to arouse, and by that time it's starting, snow is melting and there's some food out for the female, she doesn't have a seed cache. She comes out, she's ready to be bred, and then give birth to the young, and then she's got to eat green, high-quality food. Whereas the males are, they're wanting to breed as many females as possible, but they have to have a territory, and that means they fight other males. But they're also coming out when the snow is the background, and they're not cryptic, they're not white, and so they're very, very vulnerable to being killed by big avian predators like big hawks and eagles, and by ground creatures like foxes and particularly wolves, wolverine. And even ravens will kill them because they can harass them if they can get them away from the burrow and gradually wear them down. So the animals have to adapt, and the food that they use can has to be, in the Arctic, there's frequently not a lot to select from. There's not that many plant species. So that's what I was keenly interested. But Guthrie also wanted to know, well, what plants were there? And sometimes he'd get that information by finding a ground squirrel frozen into the sediment and could get a lot of information from that, but its food cache was there. And they get seeds out of it, and he got a few seeds of grasses that are no longer growing here. They're grasses that are typical of the prairies, northern prairies in Canada.
And he'd found that in a ground squirrel fossilized?
In a net, yeah. In a nest or a cache that in the ground squirrel's tunnel where he hibernated. And so they cut that from the surrounding area, and there were a lot of other kinds of grasses and other foods that were in there as well, but it shows that it was a different environment. He knew that because there were things like badgers here, which are prairie creatures, don't occur in Alaska now, and there were ground squirrels then, but they were more widespread because there was better conditions with a lot of wind-blown lush fine silt from the glacier outwashes, and that was the ground would thaw. Even though it was cooler in the summer, there wasn't a lot of insulative material from trees that insulates the permafrost and keeps it from thawing in the summertime. There the wind would blow this stuff and the plants weren't so close together, and something could have fire. It was like a grass fire then, totally different. It wouldn't do long-term damage. It would just stimulate regrowth. So Dale and I would discuss these questions of what kind of what was the habitat like for those times? For not only these animals, but of course it has, when people came into the scene, and they were hunting these animals, well, it was for humans because they were hunting the animals and they were there because of the habitat. And of course, the archaeologists were also trying to get this information, but they weren't, paleontologists are different. They're focused more on the animals that were there, not so much the humans.
Some people don't understand that distinction, but there is definitely a difference.
But I mean, that was fun with them because they had hypotheses, and the university then was small enough. We had more interaction with other people from other disciplines, geology and the physical sciences as well. And, you know, the whole idea of the lus and build up of sediments, that's a geological question. But it wasn't getting much attention until we worked together with geologists, and we could stimulate their interests, they could stimulate ours, and correct us if we were misinterpreting what was happening because of the winds and the amount of the size, whether it was sand being blown in or forming sand dunes, or whether it was all lus or not much of anything. So,
well, that's what I was going to say, is when you mentioned working with Dale Guthrie, that, yeah, you guys were really doing interdisciplinary collaboration, which is not always so common.
Within
or
the
so
biological
easy.
Sciences, that's right. But yeah. Then we branched out too occasionally into geology, and particularly Dale, because he was working with animals that were coming out of the when this windblown lus or silt was thawing, and it was being thawed by the gold miners.
Right.
So then these bones would come out, and so then, and frequently it's hard to interpret them, because by the time they were washed out, they weren't in a layer where you could date.
Yeah, they were out of context.
They're out of context, right. And so, and Dale could do a lot of work in a museum, which he did, where a lot of these things were sent back to the American Museum at the Frick. Frick section of the American Museum. Frick was the one that paid Otto Geis, who our museum is now named after, to collect these bones from the miners when they're preparing the ground, getting rid of this overburden down to the gravel that had gold in it, which were the dredges were working on then. So there was thinking about environments that existed 15 to 20,000, 25 or 30,000 years ago, and then then there would be a gap with nothing, because then that was another glacier epoch, and you find different but closely related animals like the big saber-tooth tigers and the extra long-horned bison. They were from a interglacial, separate from the one that we're in now. And it was another glacial epoch. Here in North America, the Wisconsin glaciation was the most recent one, and then the Illinoisan was the older one, and that was 150,000 years ago that it reached its peak and was advancing before humans had arrived on the scene here and in Europe as well. So I feel that I was fairly fortunate to start working professionally in the field and here at the university, where there was all of these disciplines that were very relevant to Alaska, but wouldn't have been particularly relevant to many universities in the lower 48. And this forced all of us here to think more broadly and draw on one another as collaborating colleagues. And net result was, I think, we did better science, and our students got a broader, within those disciplines, a broader education that better equipped them to go on in those areas if that's where they're going to go.
Yeah, I mean, I would think as a student, if you have a faculty committee made up of this mixture of people from different perspectives, you as the student are going to learn from all of them and be informed on a much broader level.
But on the other hand, I should point out that, especially for me, because I was heading up the wildlife research unit, And we were training young people, many of them getting a master's degree, were going to be employed by the state and federal governments. They wanted someone to deal with the present animal populations and understand their ecology and management conservation. So we had a lot of the student projects, when there wasn't, we didn't know enough at that stage about the detailed lives of, say, bears, mm-hmm. and caribou and moose and mountain sheep and mountain goats and fur bearers, because fur bearers were then important to manage because the fur prices were moderately high. Trapping was an important part of the economy. And then because we were a cooperative cooperative within the United States, between the federal government by the Fish and Wildlife Service at that time and the universities, land-grant universities, and the
state programs, right? Weren't they part of
the state programs here, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. So, and then there was the Wildlife Management Institute, which was a lobbying for our program based in Washington. And so at any rate, the federal government's interests were heavily based on, say, migratory waterfowl and some marine mammals they were responsible for, like polar bears and sea otters and seals, mm-hmm. but not the whales, because they were not their responsibility.
No, okay.
So NOAA, the National Marine Fisheries Service, had their mm-hmm. responsibility to say that. But at any rate, it forced us to not just be stuck with, for me, for example, with members of the deer family, deer and caribou.
So the feds were interested in certain things, and that meant the state had interest in other things.
Well, I said it can't be absolute in that regard, because once Alaska became a state, the wildlife management on state and federal lands, with the exception of national parks, were state responsibility for managing the wildlife. But this is where there was a problem, because I was working on plant animal relations, and that means habitat, what's mm-hmm. habitat like. And the state structure for management of wildlife was narrow, according to the state constitution, that the focus was on understanding animal population dynamics, and therefore how they that related to their productivity, and then how they could be harvested by hunting, and case of fur bears, right, trapping, and whether it's sport hunting or subsistence hunting, then you have to know how many animals are out there in order to determine how liberal the harvest can be, and that hunting licenses and bag limits. And for the federal government, their interest was in migratory waterfowl. The state didn't have any responsibility there directly. It was the federal government. And so their interest in habitat, wetland habitat particularly, where ducks and geese and other wetland birds or all bird habitat could be dealt with. And the state then, when the Constitution was written up, unfortunately, they didn't appreciate that these wetlands are, for example, they're good for others than just migratory birds. They're important for moose and fur bears and fish. And so it wasn't just federal interest, it was federal and state. Whereas the state constitution allocated or gave responsibility for management. Their mandate for management was management only of the population of the animals and assessing, counting them, mm-hmm. assessing numbers available for harvest, whereas the habitat itself, under the state constitution, went to, on state lands as they selected them, went to the Department of Natural Resources. So then, but they didn't have anybody, and then the Department of Environmental Conservation also had some responsibility for the quality of waters, and the Constitution says specifically for human welfare and fish and wildlife, but the Department of Natural Resources and Department of Fish and Game think that's only if it's pollution issues, you know, that might relate to the Department of Conservation being called in to check mm-hmm. the water and what it is, rather than thinking of, well, what about natural problems where the water quality is changing because, say, of climate change and warmer conditions and not enough flushing of water in lakes. And when that happens, how does that affect fish and other wildlife that use those waters?
It sounds very fragmented, the state system.
And that's been a major problem in the work that I've been doing recently in Quartz Lake, because the state has not done a good management job, because they tend to think that wetlands, they can designate them on state lands as primarily for fish and wildlife, but they don't do any investigation to see whether they're being changed by, say, climate warming, forest fires too frequent, or damage by all-terrain vehicles or airboats. Mm-hmm. And that's been a major problem. And then it gets into politics.
Oh, you mean there's politics involved in wildlife management?
Well, that's part of the problem. In the early days, of course, before statehood, the Fish and Wildlife Service employed people, and that's when I was employed as a deer biologist in Southeast Alaska. We were a territory. Mm-hmm. There was a so-called game commission, but that was like 5 members of senior citizens who were had been fishermen or hunters or trappers, experience in that. And but any studies and research was done through the Fish and Wildlife Service, and then the Game Commission played a big role in setting hunting regulations and fishing and trapping regulations. And they drew on us, on the Fish and Wildlife Service, for our studies to know, again, and we were covering both habitat and animal population dynamics. So then with statehood, it's hard to blame it on the state, or because the federal government, most of the land was still in federal ownership, mm-hmm. and the state hadn't selected lands yet. And so technically it's federal land, and they should have been responsible for the habitat studies. Well, they continue good habitat studies on refuges, and sometimes in national parks or in national forests, but the state then, you know, why should they even hire anybody or establish a habitat division? So that then nowadays they do have a habitat division, but their only job is to respond to requests for permits to do something that might affect the habitat, like build a road through habitat or build a fish processing plant along the coast or build a dam, do other things that would obviously have an effect on habitat, and then it would be up to the habitat division to do some investigation to find out whether there would be serious consequences, or it could be done safely if it's done in a certain way without significantly destroying habitat. So, but it's, of course, times change, and as lands have been selected by state and native land claim settlement, and then they're under the national, Alaska National Interests and Conservation lands, then there were selection of more federal lands for expanding national parks, refuges, and to some extent forests, and creation of, and the remaining lands were under administration, I mean, federal lands were under administration of the Bureau of Land Management. Mm-hmm. But then the state was still, you know, they weren't dealing with habitat. Unfortunately, there was a good reason for them, and could be both financial and they figured the federal government should be responsible, but the federal government, when the territory became a state, they had to lay off a lot of people that because they didn't have jobs for them, and they couldn't carry on what they did before. Mm-hmm. Now, and the state technically, or not ideologically, wanted to ultimately take control of managing habitat, but they never have, because it requires establishing many new positions and a new whole program. Mm-hmm. and division within the Department of Fish and Game. So that hasn't happened, and it's because it's split between state agencies. No specific agency takes responsibility for it, and that's common wherever you are. If it's federal government and different agencies responsible for, say, fisheries in the ocean, no one takes responsibility. It's usually the fishermen complain because or it's the same problem with trying to share management of the marine environment. Mm-hmm. Between state and federal. It doesn't work very well. And sometimes it's the fishery is more than just state and federal, it's international because right. of Canada or because of the marine other countries that are using the marine resources.
Mm-hmm. So the collaborative element that you were talking about with the work at the university, did that also trickle down in terms of working with students? Was it very collaborative?
Yes,
work on projects together?
Yeah, that was one of the good things about that cooperative wildlife unit. Its cooperative nature meant that a lot of student projects were jointly funded by the Department of Fish and Game and the Fish and Wildlife Service. And I should point out that later, the federal government moved the Fish and Wildlife Service research into the U.S. Geological Survey, and so the Geological Survey then became the federal component of the co-op unit program. That was much later, though, mm-hmm. that happened in this present situation now.
Now, I was thinking you were talking about the collaboration between you and the other faculty. Were you also very collaborative with the students? The graduate students got to really work collaboratively on projects, or they went and did their research and you went and did your research?
Oh, for our individual students that were advising, no, if it was in research in something, and the at times the majority of the students were working in different aspects of say caribou or muskoxen ecology, and that included plant vegetation and plant animal relations, but it also included things like how to insect harassment of caribou, which of course relates to their nutritional well-being if they can't feed when they're in the summertime because of the effect of the harassment and disturbance of the caribou. They have to try to get away from the mosquitoes and can't feed when they should be feeding all the time. Mm-hmm. And so those kind of studies, and then, you know, studies that Bob White would be doing would be, you know, how do these animals respond in use of their body fat through the winter? Is it related directly to temperatures, or is it related to the snow depths and how much work they have to expend, the caribou have to expend moving around through snow or digging through snow. So, mm-hmm. you know, he'd be working with students doing that. I would be restricting with students that were looking at the migration and timing of migration and how food had to be available during migration, and that determined partly their migration route, whereas they were working on the costs to the animal energetically of migration, and the two just fit together. And mm-hmm. so sometimes had students that we were both working together on with the students, and sometimes more than one student would be working on the project. That usually only happened when there was a large grant that to one of us, and say from the National Science Foundation, for example, and we had the funding to have the students focus on different projects, but they related projects, and they work well together in the field. And there was true in sometimes with the waterfowl studies or fur bearer studies as well, in wetland habitats particularly.
Well, it makes sense, as you said, that all the work you were doing, the students were all doing sort of like sub things, building to understanding, like you were trying to understand caribou, so everybody was working on some different part of the questions related to caribou, and then it all kept building on each other.
Yeah, and I, to elaborate on that, I'll just mention that after oil was discovered at Prudhoe Bay, then we became very involved in studies to assess the impact of oil development, pipeline design, how could it be designed, and what is the routing of the pipeline that would, both of which might affect, have less of minimal effect on, say, caribou and their movements, on other wildlife like moose, and what are the disturbance effects that are associated with having a lot of planes and helicopters flying around and vehicles, all-terrain vehicles on the landscape, what was the effect on caribou and other wildlife. And one case of this question of a collaboration with funding agencies mm-hmm. was then, I particularly, but other people working in biological sciences were critical of the oil industry's desire to move right ahead and build a pipeline when they didn't know how to build a pipeline in Arctic conditions, and without, they had no experience in what to do with, how to deal with wildlife, such as caribou, particularly with caribou, but other species as well. And so, because we were so critical, we were the agency, and of course, environmental organizations were critical too, but they frequently didn't have the background and knowledge to, they were just sort of trying to, viewed as trying to stop the pipeline from mm-hmm. being built, stop development. Well, we were trying to slow down things until studies could be done. And of course, it costs a lot of money to do studies. And so in one case, the oil industry then challenged us, so the wildlife unit, saying, well, okay, if we put up the money to build a simulated pipeline up there in the oil field area, and using culverting and snow fences that the animal couldn't see through, building a typical type of model crossings, ramps over the pipeline mm-hmm. or elevated pipeline that they could go under. At that stage, they hadn't decided how they were going to build a pipeline. And that was one of the reasons, of course, we felt they should wait. And they were forced to wait because the main reason they were forced to wait was because they had to settle the native claim settlement as to who owned the land the pipeline mm-hmm. was going to go over, and would the natives be compensated properly if they went over their lands, et cetera. And so that gave the time for the studies in the oil industry. After 4 years delay, they were honest enough to admit that it would have been a mess if they started right away to try to build a pipeline. It would have cost them much more, and they would have made more mistakes, including mistakes with engineering mistakes, but also mistakes that would have affected, had a very negative effect on wildlife. Well, in this pipeline study, we had to draw up a contract with the oil industry. They were kicking in most of the money, and virtually all the money, except there might be a little state money through our stipend program for the students. And so they insisted initially that they would have control over the data, and that they couldn't be released to anyone until they approved it. And this was unacceptable, of course, to science, to have an agency controlling the data, and we're doing science. I mean, what standard of, as your project advances, you do, give papers at technical mm-hmm. conferences and do small publications, but not necessarily the completion ones. And the question was whether a pipeline for the oil industry, they wanted a solution to building the pipeline, and they were willing to make some adjustments, but they didn't want to make too much because it costs to do engineering. The cost would go up high, and so there's reasonable to be concerned on their part, but at the same time, it was unacceptable to have a student working up there and not be able to publish the data. So I said, well, sorry, we can't do this. And then I didn't want to do it. I figured we could maybe get some change. And I figured the best way is to go to the Fish and Wildlife Service and say, can you kick in 10,000? And this whole thing was like about 100,000. Kick in about 10,000. And if you kick in 10,000, then it's federal money, and by federal law, it has to be open access information when you're mm-hmm. for the scientists.
It's public domain.
It's in the public domain, right. So when we met together and met, I said, well, I think we can do it. Go ahead with you, and just but it can't be tied up by you because the federal government is involved in this. And so they realized they were in an awkward position, and they said, well, okay, we'll let it go. And then surprisingly, after we did this, they were the first to, when we did agree that it wouldn't release preliminary data. We're collecting studies as to how many caribou, when each time they'd move through the area, went, used the ramps, and how it was only sometimes there are only 25 or so animals, and we wanted large numbers before you draw any conclusions. And so that kind of data, you don't release it right away and draw conclusions from it. So they violated it right away. They had the media and those camera people were coming up from the media, and they were giving me a tour around, and one of their so-called biologists was jumping to conclusions, and that got into the press. And we complained, and they backed off, but it was already published, and leading the impression that, say, gravel ramps were going to work best, and our studies didn't indicate that at all. Mm-hmm. And they didn't mention that most of the animals were deflected and didn't use any of the facilities. So they didn't want that information out. Anyway, when we finally had an invitation for a PhD student to present a paper in a conference in Canada, he submitted an abstract, and it would draw the conclusions from that study that was completed for the summer, and showing you know, what we'd learn from that and what the ratios of animals moving across the pipeline was. And the oil industry said, no, you can't do that. The study is, you didn't clear it with us first. And we said, no, that's true, we didn't. But this is a student just presenting his information. It's not the final publication. Yeah, it will be open and available to the public for sure, but you violated the rules anyway earlier. And, you know, they're great at saying, we're going to get hire lawyers and we'll take you to court on it. And, well, we got our university lawyers, and they quickly pointed out that, no, it wouldn't go to court, and we're on firm ground. So we helped educate the oil industry a bit about dealing with this.
Well, that sort of leads to a question of the neutrality of science, and for you, in becoming an environmentalist, how you reconciled those with things you may have been finding out in the oil fields that maybe you didn't
like.
Well,
before I respond to that, I'm not sure how you define environmentalists when you ask that question.
Well, I have a sense of you that you believe in the protection of or the conservation, I should say, of nature and wild places.
But I also believe in sound management, and in some cases, and if there's things like big projects that are need to be done to need for the say the economy and the country and to produce fossil fuels, which we're dependent on, then I want to be sure that it's done in the best way possible. So I didn't want to be identified as an environmentalist at that time. Mm-hmm. And so I frequently supported them. Token financial support to some, especially like the Northern Alaska Environmental Center and others, but I didn't want to be an officer on them. In fact, our advisors, our supervisors in Washington of the Fish and Wildlife Service said that they didn't say no, absolutely, but it's best not to assume officer's position, because then you are identified as an environmentalist, and environmentalists are assumed to be somewhat biased toward issues to the point where they might try to stop projects which are going to go through instead of working to make the project go through in a safer way.
Well,
I dealt with that by belonging to the organizations. But when I had data that was important and which was supportive of what the environmentalists were saying politically, then I would make that available to them and without being identified. So, and I even went to the, you know, I could be considered an environmentalist because I was frequently on the side of environmentalists, but I was not deliberately on the side. I just happened to be there because I was doing the science that enabled me to make a stand that was in agreement with the environmentalists' concern. So examples are during the Alaska National Interest Land Conservation Act, and this question of whether the coastal plain of the Arctic Refuge would be even part of the refuge. The pro-development interests wanted it open because they were convinced that their seismic studies said that there must be oil down there. And whereas our research showed that this coastal plain was a major, especially for caribou, but for migratory birds as well, and for other species, was critical habitat that were essential for caribou herds, and that if you're going to be consider developing the area, you've got to know the consequences for caribou. And we were doing intensive studies. There, some of it was according to the when the final legislation was passed, there was compromise that it was not given wilderness status, the coastal plain, but then it was also a special D2 status that allowed some surficial seismic work to better understand how much oil might be there, but also time and money was appropriated through the Fish and Wildlife Service to study the effects of how the wildlife, what was the status of the wildlife, and then how development might affect them. So the botanical studies that identified critical habitat components for, say, caribou and muskoxen, and we were involved in all of these studies, and I had several graduate students working on aspects of this. And then when the Congress would attempt, say a pro-development Congress would attempt to change the status and open up that area for oil development, then this congressional subcommittees would be studying this and what was known. And so I was frequently called to go to Washington and testify for the Fish and Wildlife Service. Once you're there, then I was expected to be a good scientist and stick to that and not tell your personal feelings. And it was difficult at times because we had people like Don Young and Senator Stevens who were on these committees, the Senate one Stevens and the House one Don Young, and they were, especially Don Young, they were trying to discredit you as a scientist and trying to do anything to make your presentation questionable to the whole committee, because there were representatives from both development and conservation interests on there, usually related to party politics, but there were always good people there, and though there was, I usually could come, you'd have to boil everything down to, you know, like not more than 25 minutes or something like that with charts and maps, and that was a challenge. But the big challenge, which I ended up enjoying, was the questioning from the members. This went into the congressional record, and then Don Young would ask questions, and his weren't often thought out well, and he'd say, well, look, caribou can go over the Brooks Range with mountains so high, why can't they go over a pipeline? And so, you know, I could point it out that, you know, even caribou don't, even reindeer don't go over pipelines. And we had another study out on the Seward Peninsula with reindeer, and they don't go over pipelines. They're not jumpers. You know, if they were antelope, they could jump it.
Oh, but don't reindeer fly? Can't they just fly over the pipeline?
No, this was when they were going to lay the pipeline on the ground. And so then he asks, well, why do they have to go there anyway? Why do they have to get to the winter range? I mean, he just opened himself wide, and I'd say, well, that's where the winter diet is different. It's on lichens. And he said, well, why do they have to eat lichens? I mean, he had checked on some literature that some caribou, some places, like out in the Aleutians or reindeer in the Aleutians, they can live without lichens. If there's green vegetation available all winter, they get by fine. without lichens. And when they put on islands, they sometimes eliminate lichens. In South Georgia, reindeer, they adapted, they limited the lichens, and the population boomed first and then crashed, and they limited a lot of plants. But it was mild enough, and some of the plants were resistant. Grasses, some bunch grasses were very resistant to overgrazing. And so, I mean, when he asked me about this, I said, I could respond by saying, well, when he asked why they couldn't digest something else, I said, I saw the opening. I said, well, they're specially adapted. You know, they have a rumen, and they have to build up microorganisms to digest, that specially designed to digest the lichens. And then in the wintertime, they're somewhat unique in this regard. And so he realized, here I was going on lecturing, and then he said, oh, I know all that. And why did you ask the question? No, that's what I felt like saying. But it was obvious to others that he had put himself in that awkward kind of position. And then when he realized he was just embarrassing himself, he said, well, no more questions. So that's all in the record, which is nice. And then another time later, another effort, much later, under it was a Republican administration. I'm not sure whether it was Reagan or Nixon. And
or Bush.
I don't think it was George Bush, but at any rate, it might have been. At any rate, not the most recent George Bush, but at any rate, again, there was an effort being made by the Republicans in the Congress to try to get this up on the floor for a vote, as what opening up the coastal plain of the Arctic Refuge for oil development. And so the Fish and Wildlife Service had been, you know, the head of Fish and Wildlife was a Republican appointee, and, you know, his attitude was, well, just we want good people working for us, and they're supposed to be outside of the politics, but just lie low on these things and don't get too involved. The immediate supervisors were great. You know, well, if Fish and Wildlife Service wants you to go there and testify, that's fine. You know, they'd pay your way and everything, and pay your living conditions while you're there. So in this case, I had a phone call from the Alaska Coalition of Conservation Organizations, mm-hmm. and they wanted to know if I would be willing to go and testify there and on this issue of the importance of the coastal plain air for mainly caribou, but also muskoxen. And I said, yeah, I would be willing to, but I have to get approval to go and something like that, and from get travel approval to do it. But they said, well, assuming you're willing to go and we paid for your way, could you go? And I said, well, the only way I could do it then if I took leave of absence and from my work, and which I knew I could do, and it would be unhappy for people in Fish and Wildlife at the top. So they said, well, we'll ask the director of the Fish and Wildlife Service if they paid the way, could I go there and without going on leave of absence, because they felt they wanted me as a scientist, and I worked for the Fish and Wildlife Service, they said, my immediate advisor said, yeah, just go ahead and put in the travel request, and it's up to them whether they approve it or not. So I submitted it, and they didn't approve it. And so I contacted the Alaska Coalition and explain things, and they said, would you be willing to go if you were subpoenaed, if we had you subpoenaed to go? And I said, I hemmed and hawed, and I said, yeah, I would. And so they said, well, we're going to use that approach, and the director of the Fish and Wildlife Service, but I think he had cave in then, because it had come up in the public and the media, and we realized we don't want to put you on the spot, and they were good about that. But they said, don't be afraid to say no. You wouldn't do it because we realized it's could be awkward. And I said, no, I believe in what I've done, and I think it should get out there. And if I don't care whether it's you or the Fish and Wildlife Service that pays my way. So the Fish and Wildlife Service director caved in on that, and they said, okay, no, he can go, and we can pay his way. And then my advisor, who was head of the co-op unit programs, he said, okay, we can pay your way, and we can pay for all of your housing and everything, because we'll have you stop by the office, and we want you back there and talk to you too about the program, and we don't get a chance to do this enough, and want you to talk to some of our people about what you're doing. And so then we told the Alaska Coalition that, yeah, that would be okay.
Well, that's a good example, maybe, of how you reconcile. So you had done this research, and the research, in your mind, showed the importance of the habitat. And so, therefore, in your mind, you didn't want to see that open to oil development?
No, I didn't say that. In fact, that they would, Don Young and people would ask me, well, how do you feel personally about it? I said, my personal feeling is, I want to see the public well informed, because they're the ones that should be making this decision, not me. And if you're representing the public and your constituents, I want them to be well informed too. And that's the way I believed. I mean, if you want, tell them your emotional feelings, and that's what's guiding you in your science, you lose credibility immediately. I mean, they may respect you as environmentalists. I didn't want to be respected as an IMS. I want to be respected as a scientist who frequently is doing studies that's supporting environmentalists' position. So, yeah, I mean, if he asked me if I was an environmentalist, I would said, well, probably about like you. We all we don't want to see the environment destroyed, and I'm interested in using my science to make things go as smoothly as possible. And I think I don't agree with opening it up without adequate information. And I'll point out what still needs to be done before we even consider necessary to be done, that we have the knowledge to pass on to the public and inform them adequately. And this is a democracy. I didn't say all this, of course, but this is what I feel. I would have said it if I was forced into it. And that's the only way to beat people like that. If you do otherwise, it polarizes. Mm-hmm. And then you lose. That's the problem with the two-party system, is it gets too polarized so easily. The middle ground is, in a democracy, it's the middle ground. It's compromise that makes democracies work. And so we lose sight of that frequently.
But so the studies that you were doing at Prudhoe and on the coastal plain, you didn't go seek out those studies and say, I want to go figure this out because I want to stop this development.
No, definitely not.
You did it the other way around. Yeah. You were wanting to understand the caribou and their behavior.
And to me, that's informing the public. And this is a public area, all of the, not just Alaskan protected area, it's a nationally protected area. And yeah, it's a wildlife refuge. And yeah, but I'd be willing to say, yeah, that's a wildlife refuge. And if you're going in there, you've got to have special considerations, just like research for oil impact on the Kenai. I was involved a little in that. And, you know, it's the government can override you, but, and they can interpret what you're saying as you're just trying to hold up development. Well, people don't like this. You know, it's like the scientists used to joke about scientists going before members of Congress or committee subcommittees, and I said to the legislators, say, those goddamn scientists, you know, they say, we got to tie their hands behind them, because they say, on the one hand, but on the other hand.
And so how do you deal with that?
This is what I'm saying. I mean, if you don't know, you got to have humility. Scientists frequently don't have, and that's the problem with a lot of young scientists that are called to testify or are interviewed, and they don't know the answers, but they think that the interviewers say, well, you're an expert on this, therefore you should know the answer. And the question they ask them is not what they were doing, but it's an ecological question. Well, the ecological question is so damn complex, and you have to do a hell of a lot of studies before you even can build models, and models are not good representation. They're as best you can do at the time, and you use those to project into the future. And the best thing to do always is to say, you know, this is the where we're beyond going beyond the limits of our knowledge. And if you're building models, then you can't say it's they're educational. They help us to point out where we don't have enough knowledge, and it's great for doing more research. So where do we need to do more research? Well, this can go on forever, and that's what Don Young will say. And he did say it once when I was giving a talk. They asked me to give a talk in the Chamber of Commerce, and Don was going to be giving one, or had given one, and I got up, and I said, we, in effect, we don't have enough science research done yet to be able to answer a lot of these questions. And one of our, the deans at that time, who was the head of engineering, he was a good guy, but, you know, it was like all the biologists are environmentalists, and the engineers were all pro-development. And he made some statement once that, I don't know why we need to, why you have to go up there, spend all the taxpayers' money up there. It's just a vacation for you to study moose or caribou, stuff like that. I mean, we don't need all that information. You know? And it was, Anders C. was saying, well, you know, we've got lots of experience building pipelines in the desert. There's nothing that'd be more difficult than the desert. And you say, well, maybe not more difficult, but the desert is certainly not the Arctic, and there's different issues up here. And oh well, we can engineer that. We'll do. We have good research component in our industry, and they do. And you know, they were trying to find the best way. And then the pipeline, they're dumbfounded. How do you keep this hot pipe from thawing the permafrost? And somebody, non-oil industry, came up with the invention of these pipes with the non-mechanized cooling.
The venting kind of.
They cooled, it had a refrigerant in them, so mm-hmm. they cooled the, they worked only in the winter. They in terms of cooling, because of the colder temperature up here than down below in the permafrost, so it literally pumped the fluid down, fluid would liquefy up here, or solidify but not until it got super cool, more than 40 below. And so it would be pumping heat out and replacing it with super cold refrigerant. So super cooling is the way it was doing it. And so, you know, it made sense. And then these steel pipes, you know, sucked heat down in the summer, but there was this bulb of super cool around the pipe supports, that it wouldn't be enough to thaw the permafrost.
Well, and this was thanks to engineers who figured that out.
Of course.
Right. So you needed biologists and engineers.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
So.
But the engineers figured it out, and they could figure it out with biologists. They figured it out. The engineers didn't have to use biology on that. They had to use physics.
No, I know, but you're saying how they said you didn't need one or the other. You needed both.
Well, not in our studies. We didn't need some things like radio collars and things like that. But no, you had to have humility about, if you're an expert on the environment, and you got to know the environment, and you can't know it unless you've done adequate research. And so you should know the limitations of your knowledge and not be afraid to say, well, I'm sorry, I can't answer that question. I had used that approach with Bill Wood, the president, once, and we were down, I was giving on a panel, and I think Terry Chapin was on that about vegetation, and I was on there about caribou, he was in the audience. Bill Wood was in the audience, and just right there, down there in front of me, and I had run-ins with him, and he said, he raised this question, why don't caribou do something different than what they were doing, you know? And why is this, and it had some behavioral and related to, I think it related to migration, and why do they have to go to specific areas, and how do they know to go to other areas? And so I looked at him and the rest of the audience, and I said, well, that's a good question. I could answer that for you if I was a caribou and could communicate with him. He saw the humor in that. I said, okay, I see your point.
Well, that was your next research, is to become a caribou.
No, there's a limit to knowledge about somebody else's ability, some organism's ability to think differently than us humans.
So I was wondering that how you got involved in all this research up in the oil fields and all that is, that the oil industry approached the university to say, we need research done and we know you know about caribou, or did you go to them and say, you're developing up there, we need to understand it better?
No, here's where the environmentalists played a big role. I mean, there were things like the Alaska Conservation Society and the, I don't know whether the Northern Environmental Center was functional then or not. It probably was, just getting started then. And they were essentially asking good questions. Well, how can you build this and you don't have any experience? And sometimes, you know, I was being asked to talk to people about this and caribou and pipelines. And yeah, I had some knowledge, but my knowledge was based mainly on some of the work I did in Scandinavia, where they had pipelines for hydro development. Mm-hmm. And how it might interfere with movement of some of their caribou or domestic wild reindeer and some even domestic reindeer. Power lines, we were starting to, we didn't have much data, but these were concerns. And then the Russians in the Taimyr region, where they had found all this rich nickel and other minerals, and that's where the biggest herd in Eurasia occurred, the caribou herd. And they there were a lot of problems there with pollution and impacting lichens. The main thing with regard to caribou at that time that related to pipelines was they were building, it was even more polluting than it was. It's still polluting, but they were using coal there wasn't a lot of coal, but they were mining as close for, because everything had to be fairly close. And then they finally got natural gas. So they built a pipeline, almost the same size as the Trans-Alaska pipeline.
This is in Russia?
Pardon?
This was in Russia?
Yeah. It was at that time the Soviet Union, and it was in the Taimyr, which is down near the lower, it's in the Arctic, and it's down near the lower end of the Yenisei River. And so they founded this town of Norilsk in 1939, and at that time it was like 300,000, they learned the hard way. It was also part of the Gulag Archipelago when they were building it, and so the prisoners, went on building and being worked over, and they didn't think about cement. If you freeze, they were using blocks and bricks, and it was just how many and how hard they could make these people work without feeding them too much. And they went ahead and used the cement that without putting stuff in it. It was just other than water, and it doesn't set up properly and doesn't have any strength. And so these things were falling down frequently as fast as they were building them. And then they were building them on permafrost with a heated basement. The buildings were cracking. And at any rate, they were learning the hard way. But the pipeline thing was wonderful to reduce the pollution to some extent. What about the caribou? And they just built the pipeline, didn't ask these questions in those days. And when they had biologists over there were trying to get them to do it right. Not too many, but some. And the response, some places they could get under it when they kept the pipeline going across a ravine or something, if they mm-hmm. went down under it, but they weren't making. And then they started making crossings like gravel ramps or wood ramp, and then put gravel or vegetation on it. And so there was some experience. The caribou were being deflected. So they were being deflected, and they'd come into the town, and they weren't getting into areas where there was good food. And there were a lot of other problems with the caribou, but that was hardly it. And so then the big question was, if they continue to be deflected, they eventually give up, and they're overheating the range where they're all bunched up against the pipeline. So they figured to build some fences to deflect them away and toward other places where there are better lichens available. And some of those were places that had been reindeer areas, but when they collectivized the reindeer, they shut down these native peoples that were in those remote places, and that made some range available. So they had a lot of lot more experience than we had on what was done. Then there was a railroad in southern Norway and through the Alpine area, Hardangervidda railroad between Trondheim and Oslo. No, that was between Oslo and Bergen, yeah. And the road, part of it was, on the branch to Trondheim. And And what happened there was the caribou, what they call wild reindeer, but their caribou stopped crossing the railroad and the road. And then they overgrazed this one side, and didn't, the other side went ungrazed, and the lichens came back big. And so that was an example of, well, transportation corridors are going to obstruct the movement of animals, and in this case, it was trains and vehicles, and that went on for many years, and finally the herd went down, and then it started coming up again after there was some recovery, and then suddenly a bunch of them crossed, and then they did well. They didn't cross, and you had two separate herds. Hmm. And at any rate, there's a limit. And what we're learning on, and still are learning, is that you can't extrapolate too much between herds in terms of their behavior and movements. It's tied to the habitat, but it's also tied to the tradition and whether there's hunting in some areas or not. And it's like the natives saying, you know, you never shoot at a river crossing or something, you never shoot the first ones that come. Let them go. Otherwise, the herd's life will be turned. And, well, it makes sense. And the Russians had learned the same thing. And so there are a lot of things like that. It's not clear-cut. And that oil industry hates that, if nothing is clear-cut. But anyway, it was the environmentalists that, you know, they would ask me to talk about what we knew, and then, you know, what is needed, they'd ask. And that's great, you know, for ask the science what is needed before it can be done right. Because it was pretty obvious to environmentalists that the pipeline was going to be built. There's so many megabucks involved in all of this. But let's do it to minimize the impact. And of course, the oil industry say, yeah, we want to do it right. But they didn't know it was right. And so, and then from then on, since I was frequently being asked to talk about this, and I wasn't saying, I was careful in using my language, saying that I was responding as a scientist, and I was speaking as a scientist, and an ecologist, and a caribou expert, if you want to call it that, and there's a big limit to my knowledge, but there are kinds of research, if we could do them, we could better answer the questions that related to the pipeline. And some of the studies that weren't just us doing them, there was a proposal then to build a gas pipeline right away across the Arctic Refuge. And you know, because they wanted to get over to into Canada right away, mm-hmm. rather than going all the way down. It was, of course, the timing was poor, but there was oil money or gas money that oil companies that funded these studies, because a lot of people were saying it's a compressor noise. It's not, you know, the pipeline was a gas pipeline is a lot different because it's not heated. And you could probably put a smaller one down on the ground that they could jump over, or you could make ramps without a trouble. And part of the problem is with ramps, then how do you keep it from thawing that area right under the ramp if you cover it up? So then you have, we told them the only way you can do that is to build, either refrigerate a pipeline. So you have to have a compressor and power for that. And it was done down on for the Nelchina herd along on Glen Allen there. They did it because our studies showed that in forest habitat, they're more likely to be obstructed than in tundra because they can't see the pipeline until they get there. Mm-hmm. Well, that was the behavioral studies showed that, but in reality, They didn't seem to be so mined because they're going under branches and everything, going through a forest area. And sure, it's cleared for the pipeline, but they would go under elevated pretty easily. And this is where there's permafrost. And then the conclusions made, and I wasn't so involved in that. It was people work in Anchorage working biologists, and I probably would have made the same assumptions. But they also had movements of moose in that area, and so that had to have a pipeline higher, and the company wanted to bury it there if at all possible. But then they didn't want to have to build a refrigeration deal. It turned out they did bury a long stretch of it, a couple of miles, and had a refrigeration unit with pipes down the soil and motors that were going all the time. And so the animals didn't have anything above ground except the clearing, and it was just like walking across a road with no traffic. Mm-hmm. There were no shoulders or anything. It's all smooth. And so that it's questionable whether that was justified or not. I don't know whether they're still, now it's buried, they have to keep it refrigerated anyway.
Right.
But so there were, and we couldn't, what we learned from that study of crossings was if you make a ramp that's the width of this house, say, it's not enough. From a distance in the tundra, and a group of caribou, and they're trying to move to the coast to get away from insects, they see the pipeline, and that if it's a ramp, they don't, just it's higher, and we found that they don't like to go across something that they can't see the other side, like a road. If it's built up, they can't see the other side. Why? Because it's the same if they're going through shrubs, riparian vegetation on the stream. It's where wolves can sit there, and when they come across, there they are. And not that the wolves would be there, but the wolves also did use the road to get up high and watch where the caribou were coming. I mean, there are a lot of these things that, you know, it's so complicated when you factor in predation and the behavior of wolves, and then that's really complicated too. And so that's a big problem with people don't want to address and attempt to understand ecology because it's too complex. And, well, we have, if you don't study it, you pay big prices economically because you do things that are not necessary, or you don't do it right and it doesn't work. Whereas if you did it right, it would work. And so, but it's hard to convince anyone, oil industry or anybody else, whether they're highways or what have you, that this is the way to do it. It's almost impossible to teach adults ecology in relationship to animals and their habitat relationships as related to the things that need to be done, like building roads or building dams and what have you, that interfere with the movement of animals, not just the movement, but their access to food and stuff. And then there's a lot of things being learned about big impoundments and how that affects caribou back in eastern Canada, in Quebec and Labrador, where they had, for a lot of a while, that was the largest herd, the George River herd in Quebec and northern Canada. And that's where they had, Quebec particularly, had all these fabulous lakes, and so they dammed them and produced energy and fossil, got rid of fossil fuel dependency and sold this access to the entire eastern United States, and still do. I mean, it's great, clean, relatively clean energy, but there's never enough, of course. Mm-hmm. but what they learned is on these reservoirs, there were problems because when you have a drawdown in the wintertime, well, before the drawdown, it's just a lake, and they don't have any problem going across. But as the drawdown comes, the ice cracks and goes down the part that's floating, and the rest of it is on the banks, just these steep, icy slopes. Mm-hmm. So if they try to cross there, they're going to have a problem climbing back up again. They can always find places, but they may have to go several miles and it can before they can find a place where they can get up. And how much energy do they spend doing this? And maybe they don't get back and forth. And if there's wolves around, they might be more vulnerable there by wolves going down there. And you know, in some cases of snow conditions on the slope on top of the ice, they could go up without too much trouble, but other cases not. Well, then the big thing that happened there is they had this big dam, and they were needed to do some work on it, so they let a bunch of water out, and the caribou were migrating below the dam, and the usual crossing place, which was kind of tricky. It was already rapids and rock, going through rocky spires and splitting up. And it was caribou would do it, and maybe there'd be a loss of a couple animals in a big herd going across, but 10,000 drowned when they did this because they were releasing all this water to lower the dam to do some maintenance on the thing, and they released it all at once, and it was just too much. And so here are these 10,000 caribou on the beach, and the people downriver, native people at the village, they were concerned in the past because of the water being getting too much mercury. In the new reservoirs, there was more mercury coming out of the rocks. And for a while, it was coming down. After a while, it slowed down. But that was dangerous, and the Canadian government was trying to do all kinds of things to clean things up. And they were right down on the Hudson Bay, the village. And then when this happened, the natives heard about it and said, well, they're all decomposing and that's coming down into the water that we drink. You know, 10,000 caribou, that's a lot of decomposing animals. So then they did all kinds of things. They got helicopters and just carried these long way in away from the river, which was a quick solution. And they could obviously be scavenged on and decompose and what, over time, not a big deal. And it was too late to salvage any meat, and when they finally got into this, but it made the international media that, you know, it shows that, you know, you think things are all okay with these big dams and stuff, and then suddenly this goes wrong. Well, you got to think about this all the time, that these possibilities can occur.
So on the studies you did on the caribou up north and the things you learned, do you think those things have been applied? Do you think you were listened to?
Oh, a lot was. And it varied, how it was applied varied with the companies. BP was one of the better ones at that time. The present BP isn't, that, you know, they sold out and then they bought back in. But at that time, it was some of the heads that were Englishmen who were working up there, and they were good to work with. And, you know, sometimes they offered to fly me up in their jet, and they wanted answers to quick questions. And one of the questions they had, not when requiring me to fly up there, but caribou movement to the coast, and this is, you know, they need roads, and they need work camps and good facilities for the people, and then they're going to have gathering pipelines. But it's a big problem is any infrastructure. Where can you put it? It's not going to be. At first, you know, they tried to find a place where the ground was not too wet, you know, not shallow lakes and stuff. But and you know, they had this problem with water too, fresh water. But at any rate, we had a study that was done. We were involved somewhat, but it was done through ABR.
Mm-hmm.
But it was some of our former students, and they did these aerial in the summer, in the fall. Let's see, it would be in the spring, I guess it was, before it greened up. They could fly and take pictures of these routes where there were lakes, and they couldn't. The caribou wouldn't go across the lakes to get to the coast. They would go between them. And sometimes the corridors were narrow, you know, like they're only, you know, half a mile or so wide, and or less. And you'd, from the aerial photos, you could see the old trails where they were all going through certain of these corridors. There were more than one corridor, and some of them were primary corridors. Well, we could show these to the BP, and they'd could say that this would be the wrong place to build your work camp or whatever, and infrastructures there, and be careful with pipelines there, the smaller diameter pipelines. And BP, in fact, said, well, thanks, we'll do that. And they did it. And so we had a lot of good relations with some. And then the ConocoPhillips, no, it wasn't ConocoPhillips, it was just Conoco, was a much smaller company. They only had, at that time, only had, in Alaska, they only had this one area where they had a couple of wells, but they needed to get a road about 12 miles long into the facility that they were building where their workers would live, and they were designing everything to have minimal impact. So then they want to know where's the best place to build a road, because caribou are in there, and some areas were pretty good insect relief area, and others were not. But they were going; they had to move up parallel to the road frequently, and so if you got it, you had to know more about where the insects were bad. So we had a student whose name is. He's currently in charge of this Western Arctic herd management for fish and game. I know he was my student. His name, always have a hard time pulling it out. And I know him well. And he's a terrific guy. And he did this study. It was a hard one because he had to deal with both mosquitoes. And then we'd go, for mosquitoes, you use a net, and you'd walk through it certain times of the day, and you had to do it enough because it varied with if there's any precipitation, it was different. When mosquitoes, and the right temperatures, when mosquitoes would be, if it was too cold, the mosquitoes were all down in the, and wouldn't come up. Mm-hmm. They weren't bothering. They were down in the vegetation. But you wanted to walk through there, so about the same as when they're most harassing, and with a net. And then you walk a transect line, and then you sweep with your net periodically, measure the distance, and then you count the mosquitoes that you get each time quickly, and they go into the special net in the bottom of the net. You can put a vial there and take these samples. Then you can do the counting later on back when you're in a building or something, or a tent, wherever you're staying. And then you do these over again in different weather conditions. And so you can see the weather, but also then you're comparing these transects as to where's the best place for the road to go. And the ConocoPhillips were so good there. I mean, they tell them, you know, you could, you know, you're part of the contract, we're not supposed to provide services to you that costs us money. But yeah, if you want to wash your clothes in our cafeteria and use the facilities here when you're in the area and eat in the cafeteria, yeah, just go ahead. And they were just really nice people. And so then he finished this, and he did the master's thesis and passed all that, and it was a nice thesis, and they got a copy of the Conoco, and then shortly afterwards, they announced it to the media that they were giving this conservation award they have in the company for it covered all of their areas in the world where they had conservation projects and going on, that this one was best one and doing a good study that related to the environment that helped them build a road more safely. And so it was like about a $5,000 award, and they some people were saying, well, the students should get the money. And the award was to the wildlife unit, and the students should be acknowledged that we got the award. And the student, I said, no, we're going to use that money to support students and the future, and we really appreciate all this. And then they finally, there was agreement, and why can't I remember his name? That's right here. I just remember. No, I shouldn't get up, but it's in this right here. Yeah, there it is. He's responsible for co-management there, largely responsible, not completely. Jim
Dow.
You got it.
Okay.
And he's just so proud of that guy. He's for this stuff, but for all of that. And with the working out a co-management program, it's only one in Alaska for wildlife management, and it works. And it doesn't keep the herd from declining, but it gets the local people involved, and they know why it's declining. And it's not because they weren't, it's because they weren't harvesting as many as they could have, but they weren't, they had so little harvest, they couldn't bring it down. And so they weren't, you know, they didn't waste a lot of money on wolf control there and things like that. But he'd bring the natives along as observers, and they got to be good observers and counts, and so he's had wonderful cooperation with the local people, and they respect him highly, which is great.
Right. So you gave some good examples of things where you were listened to on your recommendations based on the science up in the oil fields. Were there other instances where your study showed the way caribou might react and the oil industry ignored your suggestions?
There, generally, Exxon Amoco, I think it was, that combination at that time, they were not good to work with. They were hiring consulting firms that had a poor reputation, but just to discredit not so much our work, but the fish and game work that they, I mean, Exxon's always had this problem of spending millions and millions on studies to discredit good science. And climate change related is a good, not at that time, but that's what they've done. And of course, they're the ones that don't stick to the Cape Thompson project. You know, they were supposed to have the gas and oil coming out of there years ago.
Oh, the Point Thompson.
Point Thompson.
Oh, they had been given the lease, and then they never developed it.
Yeah, and they get away with it because the state government would okay it, you know, let them give them more time. And they're apparently building a pipeline right now. But and of course they didn't pay for the damages that the criminal charges for oil spill. And they finally agreed after they'd been reduced from about $2 billion down to about $300 million. Unbelievable. And they spent probably close to $1 billion legal fees fighting all that. And that's sort of the same way the BP is now behaving in the Gulf of Mexico on the deep water thing.
They don't want to take responsibility.
Yeah.
So do you feel like the development that's happened on the North Slope has met your standards of being done appropriately, and that the caribou are being protected, or what? I don't know what the right word is, but...
The answer is no, but they went along with a lot of things, there was a compromise in what they did. And sometimes, you know, like for example, one of the problems our studies, as well as the ABR studies, showed that when insects were harassing, the caribou were, before they started harassing, the caribou located inland from the roads and pipelines, the gathering pipelines and what. And they were in one of my students did vegetative studies showing that was the highest quality green vegetation at that time of the year, was what they needed. That's where they were. When the mosquitoes came up, then they started milling around and trying to get, they move into any breeze from coming from the coast because of the sea ice there and cool. They try to move there and they mass up because you reduce the number of mosquitoes per animal, but they can't feed. And so then they try to move to the coast. And the big problem there was the main transportation corridor to the Coparic field from Prudhoe. Mm-hmm. And a lot of traffic and big trucks. And sometimes if it was dry, lots of dust flying. So from a distance, caribou in big groups don't move readily across roads. If small groups will move more readily, partly because a big group, they're still waiting for the more adventurous ones to start moving, and once they start moving, they go, and then they'll go across. But if a truck comes across, that's the end of it. They jump, go back, and it's going to take a long time to settle down. Meantime, they're being fed upon by the mosquitoes. And so the recommendations was, there's no simple solution. The simplest solution is to convoy the trucks and traffic. So that's what both state and federal came down on them, and as a study is saying, you got a convoy, and most of the convoying will be done at night when it gets too cold for the mosquitoes. Then you open up. But if you had convoys that have to go through during the daytime, all the trucks go together, and then none of them for a period of a couple of hours, and especially if there are groups of caribou that you could see were waiting to get across. Well, if they're in a distance, it didn't make too much if 10 trucks went by versus one. Whereas if none, then they go across successfully. And the oil industry responded and said, no, it's inconvenient for us, but yeah, we'll do it. And they didn't say it that way. They said, yeah, we'll do this. It's for the well-being of the caribou, et cetera, et cetera. But then, you know, what are these cumulative effects on the caribou use of the area? Well, that's what we couldn't study, that because we could point out to them that they ask if there's a problem for the small drilling field and pipelines, how do you build this so that it will have minimal effect? Okay, maybe you do it. And then they say, well, we're going to do another one over here. Well, same way. And of course, they reduce the impact by directional drilling, which wasn't in the original plan, and had reduced the footprint. Yeah, that was good. And but you know, what are the long-term cumulative effects? And we couldn't address that. And as an environmentalist, I could say, you know, that's what we don't know, and but we should start measuring cumulative effects now, separately from, you know, what was recommended to how to do one system. But if you have three systems, it's different. So if you knew how much was planned in the long-term future, you could do a better job of recommending how things be done than if you do one at a time. So the cumulative, there was a National Academy of Science study done on that, which I would have been on, but I was already on another one that was down in the Yellowstone area and had to do with the elk populations down there and their management. So I couldn't be on that, which was good for me because that would have been a tough one too. And but the people from here, they're good people on it, including Ray Cameron. You know him?
Ray who?
Cameron.
Mm-mm.
He was he did a PhD here with Bob White, but he was working for Fish and Game, and he had a plane up there, Super Cub, and he was doing all this monitoring of the caribou and how they moved in relation to pipelines, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he was on the committee. Skip Walker, you know him?
I know the name, yeah.
And is at doing it, he was from his botanical standpoint. And there was a whole bunch of others. And those are interesting things, and they're done very objectively. They finally published a book, Cumulative Impacts, and that's available. And yeah, it was important to get that out, so start thinking that way rather than thinking that you do one project well and there's no problems, and then you do another project well and there's no problems, but you put them together and there's many problems.
Well, and also, as you say, at the time you started the research, you couldn't study cumulative impacts because you were just trying to get the baseline information. But now, it's 30 years later, you can look at cumulative impacts. And do you have a sense of the results?
Well, no, you can't look at it because, like, it's so huge, a project. The costs to do this, how many people do you have to hire to do this, to measure these things? Like, you got to go back and do sampling the way it was done early on for, say, mosquito harassment and avoidance, for other species like nesting of shorebirds, where some cases, you know, they're very close to rigs when they're drilling, but they're not so close to roads unless there's dust that flies from the road, melts the snow first, and they not get a nest right away. So they nest beside the roads, and then the foxes know that there's nesting beside the roads, and they cover the nest. So those are the cumulative impacts. I mean, you know, in one sense, same with the caribou, when the blowing dust and oil that they use to keep the dust down, that's flying mud and stuff, oil stuff. What's the effect on the vegetation, and then how does that affect the caribou? Well, again, the caribou are eating some green vegetation close to the road. Sometimes it was put there because there was some erosion, and they plant some plants that are and grow quickly and fertilize it, so it's higher quality. But is it good? And then the caribou gets clobbered by a truck. You know, whose fault was it?
Well, what I was thinking about the cumulative impacts too is, maybe you faced this when you were involved and were testifying, the oil industry will say, well, you know, look, it's all great. You know, look, there's caribou right here in the middle of the oil field. You see, we're not causing any problem.
Yeah.
How do you answer that?
Well, I have to say it was a hell of a lot more complex than you think. First place, those are nice pictures for the oil industry to release to the media. Why? Because they were mostly all big bulls with big antlers. Whereas a lot of people don't even know that that females have small antlers and they shed them late so they don't have any antlers frequently in the early summer when they've got calves. And so they see these animals without antlers and they say, what are those animals? So another, then the why were the bulls there and not so many cows and calves? Because the cows and calves are displaced. It's too risky for them and to be close to the oil fields and stuff, because they don't want to be places where things can sneak up on them, like bears, grizzly bears, and wolves. So, and in sometimes there were more bears in that area because bears were getting food from improperly put away garbage. And so you have increased number of bears, and that means increased predation on the newborn calves. And they don't have a lot of wolves down there close to the coast, but some increase in wolves. And then, you know, what effect on birds is the fox situation. The foxes, population is higher than normal because it's almost impossible to keep food away from them. Truckers just throw sandwiches out the window and the foxes know there's food there. And then the foxes learn that there's more birds nesting close to the road because the snow is gone earlier. And so they clobber the nests. And, well, these are all the kind of biological cumulative impacts, but there's other potentially biological ones that other people should be measuring, like what about any carbon in the atmosphere and fall back on the land? Does this infect the snow and the quality of the meltwater, et cetera, and other contaminants that might be there? Fortunately, most of the pollution plume from the compressor stations and all these things that are burning and the gas that they're burning off for safety reasons is blown out to sea. But we don't ask the question of what effect it has on, say, like polar bears and seals that use the sea ice. Mm-hmm. And it's in the sea ice too. What's the effect in the marine environment? Well, it's almost impossible to measure that. But you can build models that where it should be and expect this. And, you know, some people are now working with Matthew Sturm has been mm-hmm. doing really good snow measurement stuff, and a lot of other people are beginning to work on that. That's good, but it's all that's costly, and so it's usually separate projects, and they're not cumulative. The only way you can do the cumulative is to address, interview the people that have done research in different things and say, if you put all these together, how is it going to likely effect? And then you have one of the cumulative effects. What's the cumulative effect on the native people that used to use that area?
Yeah.
And it's horribly complicated, and you can't answer it in either a positive or negative way, because it's human culture. We're not able to do good research on us. It's easier to do it on caribou.
Well, I understand your point about how hard it would be to do cumulative research, but I was thinking, you know, well, something you studied, you know, your study showed that caribou need a certain route for insect relief or something, and now you can go back and look and say, yeah, they're still doing that, or no, now they've changed their behavior and are doing it differently.
Well,
because of the road that's there.
Well, that's the problem. I mean, the the oil industry wants us to look only at herd numbers, because herds have increased frequently during all of this development. But in the same time, some other herds with no oil development have decreased. And so what conclusions can you make from that? That all herds are a bit different because of the habitat is all a bit different. And you can't generalize on any of these things very well. Some aspects of human of caribou behavior you can generalize about. Like, we know that cows with calves don't like to cross rivers with a lot of tall willows. So it's a corridor with lacking visibility. We saw similar behavior when Dan Roby did some of his work on avoidance of the road and pipeline by caribou and the ABR too, and found that the pipeline is not as bad as roads, because roads have traffic, and the Hall Road is a good example. There's so much traffic there that, yeah, they're going to avoid that. The caribou are going to avoid that. Whereas, and pipeline's the same too. If the pipeline is by itself, you don't have this traffic, and so they're frightened by the movement, not by the thing so much. Mm-hmm. It's the same with the noise, for example, if you get close to a big diesel engine driving a well pump, it's pretty goddamn loud, and the caribou will go right on feeding through it. But it's stable, it's not moving. What'll disturb them if a lot of people out on the pad moving around and they can see them, or vehicles coming and going. That's what is disturbing to the animals. And when they did this, some of these simulated compressor sounds for gas pipeline in the Arctic Refuge, they had a permission to do that. And this was not in the coastal plain, but it was up in the hills, sort of. And the caribou, they had cameras there, and the caribou just marching along in migration, and they heard this noise, and it got louder and louder and louder, and they marched right by it and walked away from it. And it sounds, I mean, if it's stable and it's not related to something moving, and when you realize, what do they do when it's thunder and lightning and the thunder? How do they react to that horrible noise? You know, some dogs have yeah, a terrible time. Yeah. Just recently they talked about these animals that were a group of caribou in the headwaters of Jarvis Creek that were killed by lightning years ago.
Right.
I remember that, yeah. Yeah. And I remember working with mountain goats on the Kenai Peninsula, and I was sitting up on the south side of a slope looking across this lake, Ptarmigan Lake, and that's the north slope where the spring was delayed, so the snow was avalanching there, but in these avalanche chutes, it was spring, and the goats were down in the chutes because the avalanche chutes would wipe all the snow out. You know, there'd be a few alders there, but they'd just bend over, and once the snow was gone, things greened up fast, and there was all this really good stuff growing there, and there was, you know, the chutes would be sometimes less than the width of this house, and the goats would be there, and you'd hear this rumble, rumble, and the goats would hardly notice it unless it came from above. Then they bounded two or three times and got out of there and stood on the rocks and watched the snow come crashing down. And when it got through crashing down, they went back feeding. So they related to the noise in that way. But we did the studies on Greenland once with muskoxen in East Greenland. Amoco Oil Company had negotiated with the Danish and Greenlandic governments to do, this is one area that was unglaciated, there were a lot of muskoxen, and it stuck quite a ways, a relatively low hilly country. There wasn't big mountains there, right, big fjords and both sides and huge icebergs coming off. But this was good muskox habitat, and there were no wolves, no bears there, and a little bit of hunting by native people, controlled hunting, and so our job was to, I was with a team from Denmark, and I was involved with that, and with one graduate student from here, and so we were, our job, part of our job was, we're doing vegetative work too, that's the primary reason, but we tied in with this, we're marking caribou with muskox, and we'd have to drug them and put a big plastic tag, like about this size, in their ear.
Like what, with, like a 4x6 size?
Well, it was like 4x5, I think. And it'd have a big number on it. And so we could read that with binoculars or a spotting scope from a distance. So we could identify these individual animals after we put this on, and they'd be in groups. And so the question, we knew that the groups were fairly stable, but there were also exchanges between groups. So we wanted to know whether the seismic explosions, they would, it was, they didn't have a problem with, the terrain was sort of rocky till, and it wasn't permafrost problems of thawing. So they would use small track vehicles with a little drill rig on them to drill down, and then those were gone, and then they laid these charges and had wires going to a recorder. So there was not a lot of infrastructure on the ground, and then they'd set these off, and one at a time, and there would be an explosion, and the dust would, like they were only about 25 feet deep or something, so then they were measuring the time that it went down to different strata, but it was a big cloud of dust, and then a big bang. And so we then, when they told us when they were going to be doing this so that we could set up a camp out of sight of that, where the muskoxen were, close to the where the charge would go off. And these groups were like, you know, 15 muskoxen in a group, and there'd be this boom, boom, and the muskoxen would sometimes look up. A lot of times they didn't look up, and if a couple hundred yards, the thing would go up, they'd watch it go up and come down, and then they'd go on grazing. They wouldn't move, and they didn't fracture up the groups and stuff. Well, this grouping is predator avoidance behavior for muskoxen. And they don't move into that until they see something moving in the distance that's going to be a bear or wolves, if they're there in that country. In Alaska, that's the way they operate. And they do in other parts of Greenland when there were wolves present. So, and predator avoidance behavior is all important. And it's true for the caribou, and caribou want to see the predators before they get too close, so then they could run and outdistance the predators couldn't get them, whether they're wolves or bears. For muskoxen, they can't run very fast.
No.
And the calves are vulnerable. And the adults got these sharp horns. Well, they can pull down wolves can pull down a single muskoxen running. The best bet is to stand your ground and try to defend yourself with their horns. But with a group, and the females have just as sharp and as long horns, but they're not as big at the base, because they don't use them to hit together during the breeding season. And so they all run to a knoll. They like to be on a little knoll, and they get on top of that, and the calves are running like hell, and the calves are right in the middle of this group, and their butts are all touching. So if a calf makes a mistake and starts to break out, a big adult or male will come out and butt the calf, get back in there, and pretty hard too, but they don't try to hook him. And so then all of these adults are facing out, and if if the wolves assist on one side and say they're there and they're shielded and the calves are behind, but wolves tend to run around if they're in a pack, and that forces them into a circle. Mm-hmm. So there's just this nice circle of tight animals close to coast, and the calves right in the back. And so they want their group size to be big enough to do that. Two or three cows and one bull is not enough to do that. So they tend to get into bigger groups. And that means they have to move more frequently or keep moving, because if they're in one place and they're all grazing, you know, they graze it out and they keep moving, which is fine. You know, that's doesn't make much difference than they were scattered and the same number of feeding. And so at any rate, that works for them. But in that case, seismic explosions didn't have any significant impact on caribou. They were doing some others on in another area where there were flightless geese, and after in that season when the adults were flightless and had young, and it was a little more disturbing on the geese, but they would run away from the deal.
And that was on seismic also?
Yeah. Yeah. But it wasn't too significant. Partly because the geese would be close to water, and when something like that, they would tend to move out into the water as a group, which they will do with predators too. Ground predators, foxes there, or wolves.
So given all the politics of all that...
Pardon?
Given all the politics of all that oil field caribou research, are you glad you were involved in those studies?
Well, and if it hadn't happened, I wouldn't have missed it, you might say. But no, it was fascinating. I learned a hell of a lot about an oil industry and drilling and all that stuff. I wanted to know as much as I could. I wanted to better understand the oil industry's perspective and what was capable too. Where were they capable of using this diagonal drilling? And you have to know something about what's down there. And so they were good about explaining things, and I was always interested in that. And then, you know, there were a lot of other things, like, you know, how they located airfields and things to minimize having animals on the airfield would be a big problem for them. And they were pretty good about that. It's pretty important to the airfields, and before eventually they could fence them, but they didn't want a big group of caribou under insect harassment standing out in the middle of the oil field.
Yeah.
And they sometimes would get, when they're under insect harassment, if the roads, big gravel roads with not any traffic, their work roads, they would get up and stand on those roads, caribou, and there would be fewer mosquitoes because there was no vegetation there. It was all gravel.
Right.
And possibly a little bit better breeze up a little bit higher.
So do you think you learned important things about caribou through all those studies that apply
of course,
elsewhere?
Of course, and some things I couldn't have learned without it being under those conditions, where if I was just up there with no oil industry, yeah, you learn a lot, but it was, the logistics were simplified if there were roads, whereas in summertime, you come to a river and you can't get across unless you get a helicopter to move you across or something like that. And then there's always a different differential effects. The helicopters too, in the construction phase, they're a big problem because they are pretty disturbing for caribou. In the winter, they're disturbing if the helicopter pilot swoops down to give their passengers a chance to take pictures, and they don't realize that 30 below, if you run caribou hard, they get liable to get emphysema.
Oh, for breathing the cold air.
Bringing it in so fast, the cold air, right. And then I got pictures that while Dan Roby was working on that, and he made friends with the helicopter pilots since. And then the industry, that was where there was a problem too, because we said they weren't supposed to do that. They weren't supposed to go down. And the helicopter pilots would frequently say they were working for a separate company under contract. They'd say, well, nobody have told us not to do that. We won't do it. And so we'd go to the oil industry and said, how is it that these guys didn't know you agreed to not allow this to happen? How come they didn't know? Well, they're subcontractors. We're not responsible for them, period. Bomber. They were responsible. And then we had to report all this to the both state and federal surveillance teams, and they would get a severe reprimand, and they'd do a little better. But, you know, from their standpoint, they couldn't train all these people fast enough because they didn't have enough helicopters. They didn't send some up from Fairbanks, and these guys hadn't had that training. And part of it was just sitting down and seeing a film and told what not to do. But, yeah, that was the same problem with the things like not having adequate garbage disposal, quickly incinerating the stuff before the foxes and bears and other things got attracted. Well, they said these were subcontractors and they weren't working under the same standards as the big companies that we made agreements with. So there were a lot of problems like that, and that's bound to happen in any construction operation. Things are going to happen, but they shouldn't happen so regularly and such a massive and can have significant impacts. Then, if you don't want any animals killed, half a dozen caribou suffering from these harassments, but you got to be absolute on those kind of things. And otherwise, it gets out of control, and it's human nature to want a pilot to show you where there's wildlife. You know, it looks like a barren land in winter. There's just pure white. And I said, oh no, we'll be going over some caribou here shortly, or I'll swing over and you get a chance to photograph some moose or some not moose musk oxen, the group of musk oxen over there. That's human nature.
There
One time I was up there with a bunch of Bob White and some others, all biologists, and we had big bands, and I was sort of guiding them on a tour, not in the oil field, but on the haul road. And we'd stop where there were some of these problem areas, like the dust from the road blowing and revegetation and use of tracked vehicles where they shouldn't on the tundra, and what's causing thawing of the permafrost. And these are guys that I knew, and I was sort of responsible for explaining some of these things. And we're in two vans, and we're driving along, and there's a wolf. So we stop. And this wolf is one that's been fed by truckers, sandwiches, and the wolf is seeing us stop, figured. And we're cameras are out, we roll down the windows and a lot of pictures taken, and the wolf then drifting back toward the second one, and someone threw out a sandwich, one of our people.
Oh my goodness.
And so I got out and walked back there. They pled first not guilty because, we didn't really know it. I said, you didn't really know? We talked about this. What they sort of said was, what the truth was, we're just humans and we like to feed animals. Go to the zoo, and they give you opportunities to feed them if you want, they let you feed them. If they don't want you to feed them, they don't want you to feed them. There's good reasons. They can understand that. But, and kids, it's kid behavior, it's pretty hard to convince them not to feed animals.
Yeah, but kids are different than adults.
Not much difference in terms, when's the transition between kid and adult?
It varies from person to person.
No, it's an age phenomenon there. And some people become more responsible as adults than others. And look at the workers, there are a lot of young guys. And we've got this student, Dan Roby, he was a good photographer. One time, he's cruising along in this pickup, and he sees workers are stopped, and it looks like a bear. And so he got his binoculars out and camera with a long lens. And this has a big grizzly that, and these workers are standing there. They've stopped working and they've sort of in a line and looking at this grizzly, and the grizzly is interested. And this one guy is walking out with a sandwich.
Oh my God.
And so, you know, there's all of those things there. I mean, feeding the animals, macho to be out there doing with such a big, dangerous animal.
Right.
And stupidity because he doesn't understand the potential problem there. Both feeding it and getting addicted, but also it might take his hand off. And
more.
And maybe, only one sandwich. And he got pictures. He was great. He barked for a while and watching the trucks go by, especially if there was a wolf there. He's got about three pictures of a truck going by, and window out of the window comes an arm and sandwich in the air, and the wolf grabs it before it hit the ground.
And this guy was just, this is Dan, what's his last name?
Dan Roby.
How do you,
R-O-B-Y.
Okay, and he was one of your grad students?
He was one of the greatest grad students, because he then did a thesis on this caribou behavior in relationship to oil field development, et cetera, and particularly these problem things. And then he went on he was such a good student, and we're a great friend. You know, we used to go moose hunting together, and I'd go with the rest of my family, and this terrific guy. And so then I had a chance to do some work with, invited to do some work in West Greenland with caribou when one of the Danish biologist was working on his PhD when caribou habitat relationships there. And so I said, he had some good funding, and so paid my way over. And then he said he really could use someone like Dan Roby, who was familiar with the caribou work and working with me and the work he did there, although his main interest was bird physiology. Hmm. But we didn't have a project of that nature. And so I said, well, I think, you know, Dan Roby would be a good one. So I was able to, he was able to go and spent 5 or 6 months working with this Danish biologist, who was a top-notch guy, and he had broad interests like Dan. He was interested in birds and everything else. Well, then it was great because the two of them worked well, and a lot of it was tough work with big backs and hiking long distances and sometimes carrying the caribou that they shot to get information from, carrying it back for food or something, and they just clicked perfectly. And so then they got up to the northernmost part, north up near Thule, and they were paid to check out whether there were actually caribou in that area that had come across from Ellesmere Island, because they come and go, and sometimes they're gone completely. And But this is where, in the springtime, there's these little dove geese.
Those little birds.
Come into the cliffs, and the natives there, it was just like the old days, they're out there with nets capturing and laying down the nets and put it up and catch them and eat them. Mm-hmm. And so they were able to do some banding and working with the natives and living with the natives in the community. But working with these dove geese wasn't just nirvana for him, because he was mainly interested in seabirds. So then he came back after that expedition, and then he did a PhD at University of Pennsylvania, I think. Or maybe it was Pennsylvania. I think it's University of Pennsylvania, under the best seabird guy, physiology, which was his field, and did a terrific PhD. And then he this gets complicated. He worked for a while for Fish and Game right after he got his master's degree on some airborne related stuff mainly, but other things. And he was always doing a little bit with birds on the side. So then he worked on, his PhD was on off in Labrador and that coastal area there where there's lots of different seabirds and a little bit in, along the coast of Labrador. And then after he before that he had married one of our students in biology, a grad student, and Karen, and they produced two kids, and then they went when did we hire him? And we hired him. Yeah, we hired him as a faculty member here as assistant unit leader. So he was working under me, but he was a faculty member and had 5 students. And then he started doing work on birds in general, and as well as on caribou and other things. And started getting funding for work with marine birds. And then Karen didn't. I have got this mixed up.
That's okay.
Anyway, he went back and got a job before we were able to offer him a job, I guess. He and Karen went back to a small university, state university in Illinois or someplace. And then he built a program, graduate program there, and did a great job, and they loved it there. Karen didn't like the cold weather up here. She did at first, but as she got older, I think she had some asthma or some other kind of problems that she couldn't take the cold very well. She was, a runner mainly. Mm-hmm. And so at any rate, then he's now, then we hired him, and he was assistant unit leader. Then she couldn't take it, the cold weather, and so he transferred to Oregon State as assistant unit leader. He's now the unit leader there, and he continues to do a lot of seabird research, but also because it's a co-op unit, he has to do work on, and he likes to do the diversity of things, elk, a lot of work with elk and others. But he's just, and he's the calendar over here, and then finally he and Karen divorced. And he's remarried, and he goes on vacation to Africa, and he takes this tremendous photos, and he again, makes these calendars.
Mm-hmm. And, well, I have one last question about the caribou up on the North Slope and your work, and then I think we'll quit for today, which is, there's something you can think about that's maybe the most important thing that was learned about caribou through all those years of research? I don't know if that's even possible to answer.
It's not, there's a lot of important things.
Some of them, I didn't mean one.
Well, I mentioned one, is that the herds are all different. Like the porcupine herd is different from the Central Arctic herd. One of the things we learned was, and that was in collaboration with Bob White and the physiological work, but how is it that some caribou can stay up on that North Slope in the wintertime when there's some lichens, but not very many, compared to the wintering grounds where it's forests, open spruce or pine forests in Canada, I've got a lot of lichens, and that's where they're wintering. And then they go back up there in the spring. Well, they go back for a lot of reasons. They always go back to the same place. Well, one thing we can see is that the timing of the green up of vegetation is important in these areas where they go. And that's partly they feel safer if it's a cryptic environment. That means patches of snow and patches of bare ground. Because if one is standing on a patch of snow, you might see it because it stands out. But they move across them, and then you lose sight of them. The same would be true of a wolf or from a distance or bears. They're cryptic, and of course, with calves it's good. But the snow goes, and then it greens up. It's greening up, and it's fast. And the new growth vegetation is the highest quality. They have to be selective to get it because it's just coming about. These little buds and new greens, it's so digestible and it's loaded in nitrogen, which they need for growth and everything, especially the calves, and for, it's just ideal. And then they may have to go to different places for insect harassment. If they're close to the mountains, they go up high on the ridgetops. But they can't feed very well up there. But it's usually a breeze, but sometimes not. And you can just nothing but caribou on the top of a ridge, and poor things are milling because the ones on the outside of the group have most of the mosquitoes. And so they try to work their way into the middle, but they can't feed. And then they're there all day long doing that until the sun gets down and lower and it cools off. Then they start, the mosquitoes go down, they move down and spread out all of these lush green valleys and feed like mad. Mm-hmm. And it's like they forgot about the other things, the interaction with other animals, but mainly the predators, bears and eagles and wolves, mainly those. But
so you're saying, like, the porcupine herd, which migrates from the more wooded area of the foothills out to the coast, versus like the Teshikpuk herd stays more around that area. They don't.
Well, it's changing. See, that's.
And why? Yeah, I mean, that's interesting.
Why are they changing? It seems.
No, I was thinking, like, why is it that, like, the porcupine herd does this big migration and there's other animals who just stay out in the
say on the North Slope.
Yeah, all winter. They don't really migrate.
Yeah. Well, it's simple and complex. The simple is that there are lichens, but they're here and there. So they spend more time and energy and moving around and looking for lichens, whereas on the winning ground for the porcupine herd animals, they don't have to. They're moving as a group, and there's fewer wolves up there on the North Slope in the winter. Mm-hmm. And the porcupine has more wolves, but they have a lot more animals. So the average animal isn't harassed much. And they can, and they have deeper snow, but it's softer to dig in. And once you get down to the ground level, you know, you just fill up in two or three of those craters. So they have to factor in the energy costs of this plus of migration to get there. So they may go several hundred miles in migration, and that's a significant energy cost. And they do that twice a year, coming and going.
Right.
The ones up on the social, they don't have to do that, but they're not getting as much food per unit effort as when they're feeding, because there's fewer lichens. So there's a trade-off. Mm-hmm. And why migrate long distances if you're at low density, you can just scatter out and feed, and if you don't have a lot of wolves around, you don't have to be so bunched up as they do down there. But it's hard to say which one is more important, the food thing. Well, we measure and have, and that was Bob White mainly, the energy costs of, well, I did with this Danish guy too, energy cost of digging through the snow. And that, then you have to do a lot of snow measurements, because cost varies. Mm-hmm. Not just depth, but it's ice lens or right. Wind blowing harder in different places. And so you got to factor in all these things, but you realize that caribou are super adaptive too. And sometimes, how do they know to make the change when the over in the next range of mountains conditions will be much better, but what's it going to cost them to get there? And you can see do the same thing with muskoxen, which are not very snow adapted for movement. They're short-legged, and they're big animals. They get to kind of plow their way through the snow, and they not good in deep snow digging for food. Mm-hmm. Their hooves are small per unit body weight, so the hoof loading is much higher. They sink down more in the snow. Mm-hmm. And so it's best not to move, to be in windy areas in Greenland. Places in Greenland, some of it's just nirvana, because there's virtually no snow. It's all blown into drifts, and they can wander around without having to deal with snow at all. But some of the best food is under those drifts, so that as it's thawing, they're there in late winter along the edge of those drifts and getting this that hasn't been eaten yet.
Right. But it is interesting that, you know, say two groups of caribou, and why one group behaves one way and the other group behaves the other way.
Well, in different, there's differences, morphological differences in caribou, woodland caribou, for example. They don't have very big antlers. In fact, they frequently, the females don't have any antlers.
So is the porcupine herd, is that a woodland?
No
there's...
Yeah. Yeah. No, they're barren ground caribou. But I'm talking about in northern Canada and in the western and southwestern Canada, in the mountains, the caribou there are mainly feeding off lichens that get blown off of trees. Hmm. Or the snow gets so deep and it gets hard, they can walk on them and start reaching it from the trees.
Would that be the same for the Nelchina herd? Are they a woodland group?
No, we don't have any technically woodland ones. Huh. That they used to claim that. How you define woodland is complicated.
We won't get into that.
The only ones that they used to call woodland were the ones that Canadians called woodland, and those were ones right on the border of the Wrangell Mountains.
Okay.
And that's based mainly on leg length, body size, and a few other factors. But and the woodland caribou there, they in that area, they have big antlers. It's the ones that are down in the thick forests further south that don't have antlers.
Well, it makes sense. If you got all those trees, you have to walk around.
Plus, the antlers play a role in communication between caribou. So, and for example, in cows, why do the female cows that are pregnant retain the antlers until right at the time of birth of the young, before they shed? It's generally accepted now, it took a while, but, and then not everybody agrees, they retain their antlers because their calf is with them. They're also bearing a developing embryo. It gives them an advantage over other young males that are with these groups, and younger females that some of them may not be pregnant, but most of them would be. But it gives them an advantage over, and it gives them an advantage over males that have shed their antlers. So males separate out and into male groups once they shed their antlers, the older males, because they don't want to be being second nature to the food, because these females, they use their antlers to signal, you know, threaten another one, but they, if necessary, they will use their hoof and sort of like kick if another caribou comes, a young male or another female comes and tries to feed out of the same crater that the antlered female is digging. So that if they're not pregnant, they lose their antlers much earlier. It's only the pregnant animals.
So it gives them the advantage that they can have more access to places where there's food because they're keeping
hold
the other animals
hold on to it, and
away.
They allow their calf of the previous spring to feed out of their own crater.
Yeah.
But they won't allow calves from other cows to move in to it, just their own. And the others behave the same way. And so that's definitely the case, but if you're in woodland area, they don't form as big groups. They're frequently solitary or a couple of animals.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of pointless to have antlers, and the males don't have as big antlers as well. And if you don't have good visibility, you can't interact as a group well and be social. And then there is a pecking order, and antlers are involved in that. And early they were saying, no, they keep their antlers until they have their young, because they can fight off foxes, like red foxes, and even Arctic could kill a newborn because before they're up and about. And it doesn't make sense, because if you determine the average time that they lose their antlers, it's about the day before the calves are born or something like that.
Doesn't work then. Yeah. So any other things you wanted to highlight from what was learned about caribou with all those oil field studies?
About caribou or oil industry?
Either one. Or what it led to about your environmental philosophy, I don't know, but.
Well, one of the things that, as an ecologist, that is increasingly bugging me is that it's partly human nature, and you know, I was trained to be a wildlife manager, but I was being trained to be a biologist and a scientist too, and that's basic, I felt. So what you're trained to do is to try to understand a complex system of ecology, and to me, I see that as a challenge. Some people don't take the challenge. They stay focused on, say, one aspect, like physiology period and what's going on in the room and in the lab studies, and they're not too concerned about what's going on in the field. Well, that's fine. That's some science they're working on, you know, nuclear energy or something else, and it's all great advances that way. Some scientists are studying the universe, you know, pretty damn complex.
Yeah.
And ecology is the same way. Most people don't think about it. I mean, you go out with a bunch of kids and you say, oh, look at that nice butterfly. And you try to explain it, and they're really interested. And you tell them that, well, the young are feeding on the leaves of the trees, and you find and you saw a leaf that's been chewed by an insect, and oh yeah, and then you know that this animals like to eat those leaves, like moose like to eat the leaves of birch and aspen, and so yeah, if there's a lot of insects, there's not so much food for this, and no, yeah, but the moose and caribou, they always have to be concerned about if they got a calf, the wolves and bears, and so you can start to explain all these connections. The kids love that as long as you don't go too long, but you start talking that way to average person on the street, and their eyes start rolling because it's too complex. They want a simple explanation. Now the monarch butterfly is a good one that you know migrates and they think of butterflies, unless they know anything about the monarchs, how can they possibly, birds migrating, you know, they're smarter than insects, and here are these monarchs, how can they be smart enough to migrate, like birds and caribou and fish, how can they be smart? They don't, they're an insect, they don't have much of a brain, how can they do this? Well, you got to start explaining that it isn't brain size alone that's a factor. It's amazing, and you know there's, and you know what the, what do they call that moth that hovers like a hummingbird?
It's something called like a hummingbird moth. It's called something like that. Yeah, they're big.
Then, you know, then how can an animal like that be behaving and getting nectar from flowers just like a mammal, a bird? And you know, we're taught in an evolutionary process that, you know, this vertebrates are higher.
Right.
But it's not a question of higher, it's different. You know, the next generation of conscious intelligence may be insects. Most by then, all humans are gone. It would be hard for us to accept that.
Yeah. Well, they used to say, you know, in case of a nuclear apocalypse, you know, what's going to survive? The cockroaches,
right.
You know,
yeah.
Insects.
And now that, you know, this whole deal of finding life on other planets, that's so much money spent on that, and it's just academic. It's no real value. And you know, they get all excited because look, this bubbling sulfur there, and there's some possibility of some organisms that can be living and get energy from this bubbling sulfur. Yeah, it's nice to know that from an academic standpoint, but is it better to spend megabucks, you know, billions on this kind of thing, rather than resolving some of our problems on Earth with human beings, or even better understanding what's down in the deep sea? You know, life on our own Earth, we don't have as, we want to understand what's happening on Mars. On the other hand, you know, there's a lot of good engineering, science, technology comes out of this space research, but is it worth it? It's sort of like these hip operations I had, you know, why is it so successful? Why was it so successful on me? It was because of war, and a lot of pilots were injured, and it was the hips.
They had to find a solution.
And then they found ways, because doctors worked hard as hell, and then they realized that it could be done better if you did it with replacements, and they experimented and did it. So that was this war that was so good that created this capability? You can't buy that.
No. Well, perhaps we should end for this evening.
Yeah.
It's getting late. Okay, thanks.